This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. In Hollywood films, the South isn't just a landscape or a backdrop to a story. It is a history, a culture, and a character itself. Portrayal of the South in American cinema has shaped cultural knowledge of the region, but narratives have varied over time. Marcia Gordon and Laura Boies are here to talk about depictions of the South in film, from Civil War movies to contemporary dramas. Laura is film curator for the North Carolina Museum of Art and the Movie Diva series at the Carolina Theater in Durham. Welcome back, Laura.
Thank you, Frank.
Good to have you. And Marcia is a film professor at North Carolina State University and a public scholar at the National Endowment for the Humanities. Welcome back, Marcia.
Thank you, Frank.
We're going to dive into the history of the South in film in a moment. But Marcia, let's talk about some of the themes that pop up when you say the South in film. What are some of the themes that you immediately think of?
Well, I think perhaps most obviously, and especially given our contemporary moment and current conversations, it's impossible not to think about the history of slavery and the history of race and class. And that is something you see over and over again, of course, in films that deal with the Civil War, whether that is because it is completely marginalized and made invisible or insignificant, or if it's because it is addressed head on. So that's certainly something that is hard to imagine not being one of the first things that you think about when you think about the South.
And Laura, the fact is that these histories and stories about race often do take center stage in any film or many of the films about the South. And of course, the earliest and infamous, maybe not the earliest, but an early infamous example is Birth of a Nation, D.W. Griffith's 1915 silent film about the Civil War and the rise of the Ku Klux Klan. Remind us about this film.
So The Birth of a Nation was really the first American epic film. It was 12 reels, which meant it was 3 hours long. It had an orchestral score. It was event cinema before that was even a thing. And there's a huge disconnect because the politics of it are completely repellent. Roger Ebert said, like The Triumph of the Will, it's a great film that argues for evil. But at the same time, it was the peak of artistry of silent film at that time. So even with its horrible message, cinematically it was very compelling, and that's one reason that it's continued to plague us throughout the decade.
Well, horrible message, but not to all. Woodrow Wilson, for one, the President of the United States, promoted that film when he was in the White House. So
it was actually the first film to be shown in the White House. He said it was like history being written with lightning, and that the sad thing was that it was all so terribly true.
Yeah, he also appointed Josephus Daniels as his Secretary of the Navy. Josephus Daniels, one of the creators, the architects, and one of the people who created the Wilmington Massacre and coup d'etat, an unpunished coup d'etat that resulted in the deaths of dozens of African Americans and the rise of, not necessarily white supremacy, but the rise of state-sponsored violence known as Jim Crow.
I think it was certainly the revival of the Ku Klux Klan, for sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I think it's important to note that Birth of a Nation comes out, 50 years after the end of the Civil War, and
right.
It so romanticizes slavery in the antebellum period, and it's the whole logic of the film is undergirded by an absolute belief in white supremacy, and yet at the same time, white victimhood. If you give black people access to power to white people, they will not be able to handle it. All African American characters in the film are, buffoons or cruel or potential rapists or want to intermarry and will do anything in their power. So this is a real demonization. And the fact that the KKK is depicted in that final kind of chilling sequence as saving the day, saving the South. I mean, and that this got such traction in the culture. This is kind of the beginning imagination in film history of a romantic view of the South that was also deeply wrong and deeply troubling.
Now, Within Our Gates was a film that was perhaps a kind of counter-narrative to Birth of the Nation, 1920. Tell us more about that one, Marcia.
Yeah, so this was directed by Oscar Michaud, who's an African-American filmmaker who was working independently, needless to say. There's no fully developed Hollywood studio system yet, and if there had been, he would not have been allowed to make films within it. And he made films for what had developed into being basically an independent black film exhibition circuit. And this is a film that directly takes on the white supremacy and the racism of Birth of a Nation, coming out several years after it. But in the film, it is the white Southerners who exploit and cheat the tenant farmers. This is a film that takes place kind of during the Great Migration, early 20th century. It is the white characters who are the sexual predators and the murderers. And the humanity in the film resides in the African-American characters. But let me make it also clear, this is not just white people are bad and black people are good. It's much more complicated and interesting than that. And this is a film I often teach in my classes at NC State. And it is, for a low budget film, it didn't have access to any of the kind of extravagance that D.W. Griffith had. It makes its points so compellingly about the power of representation and what it means to be able to answer something like Birth of a Nation.
Well, let's take us into the talkies, Laura. You had an interesting experience with an older film about the South placed in historical context. You attended a showing of the 1938 film Jezebel at the Stagville Plantation in Durham County, right?
Yes. Stagville is a very interesting place because it has always told the story of the enslaved people alongside and given equal weight to the people who owned the plantation. And a number of years ago, they did a series of films in their visitor center. I don't know who chose them. There was no contextualization of them at all. I think it was on a VCR. That tells you how long ago it was. Mm-hmm. But one of the films that they showed was Jezebel, which is one of the many films in the 1930s in that sort of Gone with the Wind popularity era that tried to, you know, resurrect the lost cause on screen. It was sort of a pseudo-historical kind of movement. It included films like The Little Colonel with Shirley Temple, Dancing with Bojangles. It showed, you know, that slavery was benign and there was a mystical bond between everyone on the plantation. You know, it was a completely, obviously, racist view of Southern life. So we saw this in the visitor center. There were maybe 10 people there. And then we had to walk back across the plantation to our cars that were parked a ways away. And I have never felt so haunted as I have walking across the plantation grounds and just feeling the spirits of all of the people who had suffered on Stagville Plantation wanting to be heard the same way that Betty Davis and Henry Fonda and George Brent were heard in Jezebel.
Let's hear a little clip from that film, as you say, starring Betty Davis.
I was just congratulating Presley on his marriage. You from the North, Miss Dillon?
New York.
She was a Miss Bradford. Isn't that what you told me, my dear?
Yes.
Bradford. Amy Bradford. From New York. I'm very happy to welcome you to Halcyon. Thank you. You have such charming customs here.
You may find our customs, as you call them, different from those of your country.
That's a clip from Jezebel starring Betty Davis. I'm here with Marcia Gordon and Laura Boys, Movies on the Radio. I mean, talk about the fact, was there any discussion about this film afterwards or sort of trying to put it in context?
Not at all. Everyone just got up and left. It was a very strangely surreal experience because, you know, I love going to all different kinds of screenings just to see how other people do them and what all of these various experiences are, but this was truly a unique one.
Well,
I'll tell you, in 1938, when this film came out, the context it was discussed in was the context A Gone with the Wind, because this was released while David O. Selznick was in the middle of his epic kind of PR casting for the actress to play Scarlett. And so Bette Davis in this role was naturally compared to this anticipatory film that would come out the next year.
Yeah, and there's a whole story about whether Bette Davis, you know, sort of thought she should have gotten the role of Scarlett O'Hara. And we're going to talk about that. I think we'll take a break coming up soon and then come back and talk about Gone with the Wind. But it's an interesting period, the 1930s. I mean, here we have in Europe, right, the rise of Nazism and what's going on in Germany with the scapegoating of the Jewish people, which is very clear to Americans. And yet, these films are pretty popular in the late 1930s in the United States of America tell this untrue story about the life of African Americans in plantations.
Well, somehow it was thought that the South, if you were telling a story of the Civil War, the South was a more sympathetic protagonist because they'd lost the war. I mean, that was Buster Keaton's justification for making a movie about the South when he did The General. He said, you can't make a sort of a romantic movie about the victors in a war the same way you can about the people who lose, which is a logic that completely escapes me because...
Well, and it's a logic that presumes that when you say the South lost, the only people in the South were the white people, because the black people in the South,
true,
the black people 100%. Won that war. And so that was the assumption that one would make as a film producer. We're going to talk more about that. Laura Boyes and Marcia Gordon, we're going to talk about films from the South. And when we come back, Gone with the Wind, we're not going to skip it, here on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Movies on the radio today, talking about the South in film. Hollywood has always taken some liberties to make movies, try to keep them exciting and appealing. But when it comes to the South and its history, those liberties paint a somewhat problematic picture that often needs context, certainly in the modern day. With me to talk about these critiques in context are Laura Boyes and Marcia Gordon. Laura is film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art and the Movie Diva series at the Carolina Theater. Marcia is a film professor at North Carolina State University and a public scholar at the National Endowment for the Humanities. And of course, it would not be a conversation about films from the South without Gone with the Wind.
I've been playing poker with two Yankee captains. The Yankees knew there'd be trouble tonight. They sent the cavalry out to be ready for it. Your husband and his friends are walking into a trap.
Don't tell him. He's trying to trap you. Out the Decatur Road. The old Sullivan Plantation. The house is burned. They're meeting in the cellar.
I'll do what I can.
What's all this about? If you don't tell me, I'll go crazy. We thought it best not to tell you, Scarlett, but Ashley and Frank and the others have gone to clean out those woods where you were attacked. It's what a great many of our southern gentlemen have had to do lately for our protection. And if they're captured, they'll be hanged, Scarlett. And it will be your fault. Another word and you go out of this house, India. Scarlett did what she thought she had to do. Now men are doing what they think they have to do.
Here we go. Clip from Gone with the Wind. Laura Boyes, Gone with the Wind, the highest grossing film in history, especially when you adjust, you know, for inflation and $2,020 dollars. What do you think makes this film so popular and enduring?
Well, the melodrama in it is very powerful. The emotional stories of the characters. But one thing that's really puzzling about it is Scarlett O'Hara has to be the least appealing heroine in many ways. I mean, she's selfish, she's mean, she's a very odd character, yet people became obsessed with her being a spitfire or whatever kind of cliched description you were going to be of someone who sort of pushes back against the patriarchy. To an extent, even though, of course, she's embroiled in it in other ways.
Well, Marcia, tell us more about the history of the film and, again, some of the context in which it was made.
Well, I would consider this kind of the birth of a nation of 1939. You know, it's like this expensive, epic, wildly successful, critically acclaimed film. But whereas you can get very few people to sit through Birth of a Nation now, I mean, a lot of people watch Gone with the Wind regularly. And I think, you know, what Laura was talking about Gone with the Wind also applies to Jezebel, right? Because it's about this like headstrong, both of these films, headstrong white women who, you know, in a bad way, kind of self-absorbed and immature, kind of coming to some kind of maturity, and it completely erases, this is the idyllic plantation world where the South has been destroyed by the Civil War. That's the imagination here. And as I mentioned with Birth of a Nation, 50 years after, right? Now we're 80 years after the end of the Civil War, and the biggest picture of the year basically has only good things to say about life on the plantation. And when I was thinking about this film, I was looking up some information about when it was premiered in Atlanta in 1939. And in preparation for the premiere of the film, Mayor Hartsfield declared 4 days of celebration in the city and had bus and streetcar conductors, elevator operators, doormen, waitresses, and other employees in downtown Atlanta wearing Confederate uniforms and costumes of the Civil War period. And I'm trying to imagine, you know, what it would be like for an African-American doorman or waitress to be asked to put on a costume for 4 days to celebrate this film. It's painful.
Horrifying.
Imagine this.
But it leaves open the question of whether or we should watch it and put it in context. I mean, let's have that conversation, but open the conversation with Jacqueline Stewart of Turner Classic Movies, who's answering the question about whether or not we should be watching this film.
Watching Gone with the Wind can be uncomfortable, even painful. Still, it is important that classic Hollywood films are available to us in their original form for viewing and discussion. They reflect the social context in which they were made and invite viewers to reflect on their own values and beliefs when watching them now. These films indicate what images and stories Hollywood has deemed as acceptable and what mainstream audiences have found to be appealing and entertaining fare. Classic films have been and continue to be a major influence on popular views of history. Gone with the Wind, in particular, with its landmark production values, signature scenes, and iconic characters, has shaped the way generations of viewers worldwide have pictured slavery and the Reconstruction period that followed.
So that's Jacqueline Stewart speaking on behalf of Turner Classic Movies in a new introduction to the 1939 film Gone with the Wind. Marcia, how do you present these films to students?
This whole situation arose because HBO had pulled the film from its streaming services, and now it's back with Professor Stewart's wonderful contextual introduction. And I would never argue that we shouldn't watch media from the past, no matter how offensive and painful it is, because we learn from looking at what was accepted in the past, what was celebrated in the past. And so I don't think that there's any sound argument for it's better just to make things disappear as if they didn't happen. That's the only way we learn. And I sometimes show my students, I mean, it's impossible not to show racist films when you're teaching a class on film history, because that's, you know, was a prevailing belief of the people who were making the films. And so I always just encourage us to talk about it. And I think it's important to show those images and to understand that they came from the prevailing belief system of the day.
Right, and to tell the stories around it, to talk about what was happening when this film opened and to try to express all of that as context. Yeah, I think.
Well, another conundrum about this film is that Hattie McDaniel, who plays Mammy, really does a spectacular job of creating a character within a very stereotyped kind of landscape, and in fact was the first African-American to win an Oscar for acting. And when, quizzed on, a lifetime of playing demeaning parts, she said, "I'd rather play a maid than be a maid," which was, her other option. And I believe, in fact, that, she had been a housekeeper at some point. So, I mean, that's another thing that's very hard to grapple with and contextualize.
Well, we heard from a number of listeners about films that deal with Southern history that don't quite match how events actually occurred. Let's hear from Milo Payne.
This is Milo Payne from Durham, actually calling from rural Arkansas. I wanted to talk about the 1957 film Band of Angels. It's a complicated film that involves a lot of themes about racial relations, all kinds of issues about the Civil War and slavery.
Never mind what my name was. You talk about freedom. You think I've got freedom? I got a past I'd like to forget, but I can't get away from it. any more than you can get away from what you are.
It stars Clark Gable, Yvonne DiCarlo, and Sidney Poitier. There's a very cringeworthy scene where Gable and DiCarlo return to the plantation and are greeted by throngs of singing enslaved people. That's a troubling scene. I saw this movie probably when it first came out in 1957. In particular, I remember the scene of the tropical storm in New Orleans and the scenes with Poitier in the Union uniform.
White soldiers are on their way here to get you right now, but I wanted the satisfaction of taking you in. Put those on.
Milo Pine calling in about the 1957 film Band of Angels. I'm here with Marcia Gordon and Laura Boys from Movies on the Radio. Laura, I know you had a strong reaction to this film.
Yeah, so this is an extremely bizarre film based on a novel by Robert Penn Warren, who won the Pulitzer Prize in 1947 for All the King's Men about Huey Long. He was a poet laureate of the United States for a while, and he was considered to be a progressive person on racial issues at the time, but this film is so mixed up with a lot of its characterizations. Yvonne DiCarlo plays one of the archetypes of these films that deal with race, the tragic mulatto, the mixed race person who is neither black nor white and can't really fit into any setting in the South, you know, in comfort. But the character that Sidney Poitier plays is so interesting because he has a very modern acting style compared to these old Hollywood people who are basically doing, you know, another rehash of Gone with the Wind. And at one point he says that he doesn't want to lose his anger in spite of the fact that he's been relatively privileged, he's been educated and treated almost like a surrogate son by Clark Gable, that it's only by holding on to his anger is he going to be able to be truly free. And there's another line in which Clark Gable says, maybe in 100 years, black people will finally be able to get the justice that they deserved. And, of course, he's saying that at the beginning of the modern civil rights era. So it's a movie that's kind of hard to recommend because it's very bizarre in its philosophies, but it certainly isn't boring.
Well, Marcia, what are some of the narratives about the South that this film plays into?
Well, this is actually a film that I did not get a chance to see. I have never seen it before. But what I like about what Milo had to say about it and kind of building on what Laura's saying is that, you know, there can be these cringeworthy elements. This applies to every single film that we've talked about so far. But I think to recognize what those moments are and why they make us feel uncomfortable, I often feel embarrassed. You know, especially when I'm showing films to students that, oh, you know, that this was actually considered funny. Often jokes are made in particular at the expense of African-American performers. And just to reflect on the way that has reverberated, especially in representations of the South with, you know, carriage drivers and maids and, you know, mammy figures and that what that means. As we see it resurfacing, you know, 1915, 1939, what about when we see it now? How has it changed?
Well, Laura, you picked a film where the main characters are African-American and not used in caricature, but actually have voices of their own, Daughters of the Dust, featuring the stories of Gullah women. Instead of using them as side characters, they are front and center. Let's listen.
Eli, there's a thought, a recollection. Something somebody remembers. We carry these memories inside of we. Do you believe that those hundreds and hundreds of Africans brought here on this other side will forget everything they once knew? We don't know where the recollection comes from. Sometimes we dream them, but we carry these memories inside of we.
What are we supposed to remember, Nana? How we one time was able to protect those we love? On the Africa where we were kings and queens and built great big cities.
I'm trying to learn you how to touch your own spirit. I'm fighting for my life, and I'm fighting for yourn.
A clip from Daughters of the Dust, a 1991 film directed by Julie Dash, the first feature film made by an African-American woman to get national theatrical distribution, and Laura Boy's pick. Laura, why'd you pick that one?
This is a really unusual film. It's set in 1902 on a sea island off of Georgia, amongst the Gullah Geechee people, who still retained a lot of African traditions. And the language that you hear is a Gullah Creole. It was the language was kind of difficult to parse because you're not familiar to listening to it. And the whole film has a very dreamlike structure. There's no kind of straight-through narrative. It's very beautiful to look at. It's just really an unusual film. And Julie Dash really did not get an opportunity to make another feature film, certainly not one as accomplished as this. And it's also should be noted that it's a huge influence on Beyoncé, who used some of the imagery in her Lemonade album.
Marcia, what are some of your thoughts on this? And do either of you know how well did it do?
Well, I mean, you can't compare this to blockbuster films with major commercial campaigns. It has become a much admired and loved film for many people, in part precisely because of what Laura said, is that it's really a breath of fresh air in some ways, because it creates, there's no other film like it. It is incredibly original. It really makes space to think about Southern life and culture, specifically Southern African American life and culture, because that is what this film is about. In ways that no film had ever allowed for before. I mean, even think about the ones that we've been discussing before and how jarring it is to think about a film that uses a different vocabulary, even a totally different context for, especially focused on the strong female characters in the film. This is absolutely feminist in orientation. And it's really, it's just a lovely, very smart exploration of what film can do besides, you know, narratives of, you know, plantations and liberation. And it's doing something very different.
And not only is Africa's history or African history not erased, it is placed front and centered. And you're, as a viewer, you begin to understand the power of that history and how it continues to play a part, which you never would have seen in Gone with the Wind or many of the Hollywood films up until that point.
There's a very strong connection to the ancestors in this film. And even what plot there is, it's a group of people who are getting ready to participate in the Great Migration and leave for better jobs, and how you have to be deeply rooted in your culture, regardless of where you're physically located, that's the one thing that's going to give your life meaning.
Well, let's hear from a listener who nominated this film about the South during the Cold War. It is a documentary, though, not a drama.
Hi, this is Marianne Watson from Raleigh. And I'm recommending Sherman's March, subtitle, Meditation on the Possibility of Romantic Love in the South During an Era of Nuclear Weapons Proliferation. It's a 1986 documentary by Charlotte native Ross McElwee, which won quite a few awards about a third of the way through. He just looks at the camera and just talks about Sherman and the sense of lost cause.
I'm really intrigued by William Tecumseh Sherman. I think he's one of history's tragic figures. I mean, you have the irony of this man who, you know, spent 4 years in Charleston, South Carolina, and called those years the best years of his life. Later spent time in New Orleans, loved the South, loved the people of the South. And then, during the Civil War, was ordered to wage war against the South. And not just, you know, conventional warfare, as it was practiced at that time, but total warfare against a civilian population.
And that really is this undercurrent, even though the whole movie is trying to, you know, see old girlfriends and have new relationships and all the older Southern women who were trying to match him up, which, you know, put this kind of melancholic humor into it. But that tone is so Southern.
Marianne Wasson talking about Sherman's March, a meditation on the possibility of romantic love in the South during an era of nuclear weapons proliferation. Laura, an unusual film, eh?
Oh, it's so fun. It's incredibly long. It's 2 hours and 37 minutes long. But it's absolutely compelling. Ross Matthewitt was described as kind of a Tar Heel Woody Allen when this came out, and this film is laugh-out-loud funny in parts, but it's also really an amazing snapshot of what the South was like in the early 1980s. And it seems all the landscapes, the way people talk, if you live here, it's just so familiar and so fascinating.
Yeah, and Southern Neurosis is a lot less frenetic than Woody Allen's, clearly.
Well,
in this
and
film.
I would say Sherman's March was long too, so I would say 2 hours.
That's right. Didn't even get close. Laura Boies and Marcia Gordon were talking about films about the South today on The State of Things, and that conversation continues after this. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Well, yeah, watching a movie can certainly transport us to different times and places, including straight to the heart of the South. Some films have shaped narratives about Southern culture that fall far from the tree, but in others, the characters feel almost like relatives. Movies on the radio today, and we're talking about the South in film with Marcia Gordon and Laura Boies. Laura is film curator for the North Carolina Museum of Art and the Movie Divas series at the Carolina Theater in Durham. Marcia is a film professor at North Carolina State University and a public scholar at the National Endowment for the Humanities. So let's start with a clip from a listener about a film that resonated with her experience of the South.
My name is Jan Williams. I'm calling from Raleigh. And a movie that I think really portrays the South is Junebug. I just feel like everyone in the film is not even an actor. They feel like people that I knew and grew up with from small town North Carolina. And there's this one scene where they have a church supper and the preacher comes over and prays with the family like it's no big deal. He's known them forever. And it's such a thing.
Now, don't tell a lie. Who of y'all thought that he was going to get out of here without giving us a hymn?
Hey, this wasn't my idea.
Now, I know you're a little rusty, so I'm going to get Eddie McGee. Come on, Eddie, and bring your son up here. And come on up here. I'm going to help this man out. You remember the number, don't you?
I think I need the book.
It's 283.
Oh, thank you. See, this one here, he's 16. His voice just broke. He's singing bass. Softly and tenderly, Jesus is calling.
It is really centered all around the importance of family and religion. And those are two big pillars of life in the South. Portals.
He's waiting and watching. Watching for you and for me.
Jan Williams talking about the film Junebug, a film directed by Phil Morrison and set in North Carolina. Marcia, what'd you think of this film?
Love Junebug. I'm so glad that we get to talk about this. We've talked about some heavy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Junebug, I think part because the director and his team are constituted by so many North Carolina natives. They have such a great wit and humor. It's so gentle. It's so loving about North Carolina, about the South. And this is a film, you know, on the one hand, the plot is about art and being an outsider, but it's really about family and place and coming home. And I if you haven't seen this film, it's really worth watching. The performances are excellent too.
Laura?
Yes, it has a breakout performance by Amy Adams, who is just so incredibly adorable in this movie. And it's interesting because it talks about the contrast between the North and the South, but also how each family itself is like a whole culture. And when you marry and you bring a new person into the household, it's like bringing a person from another country back home with you. And the wife who's recently married, who's an art dealer, obviously had no clue at all about what her husband's family was like, what his formative years were like, why he is the way he is, because he's run away from his family to reinvent himself. And that, too, is an experience that many, many people can relate to.
It's a great... Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead, Marcia.
Yeah, I think what Junebug shares, too, with Sherman's March, which just occurred to me, is that a great appreciation for Southern eccentricity. Both of those films figure out a way to celebrate that without demeaning that. And I think that's really important.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you about, because that is the hard part, isn't it? It's that kind of Lake Wobegon effect. How do you lovingly sort of poke at the stereotypes that, you know, you sort of know that the people from the outside have these ideas about us. You're going to play to some of that, but you also want to gently disabuse them and show them how maybe they were wrong about their impressions of those stereotypes. Something like that? Does this film do that?
But also to admire and celebrate that eccentricity, and not to be embarrassed by it, and not to have to mock it. You know, so that's not an easy thing.
And I mean, they say being a Southerner is nothing to be embarrassed about, which perhaps in a more urban culture, some people might feel that that's something that needs to be said.
Let's go to a listener pick now, set in 1960s South Carolina.
My name is Elle Fleming, and I'm calling from Raleigh, North Carolina, and the movie is Shag, and it came out in 1989 with Phoebe Cates, Bridget Fonda, Paige Hanna, Annabeth Gish. There is a specific scene from Shag I remember, and they all go to Paige Hanna's character's house in the South, and her father is a senator, and she shows them exactly what they can or can't do. So they think they're going to have a great fun week at the beach, and she has this little key, and she's locking up the alcohol place where the alcohol is, and she's showing them what they can or can't touch. And she tells them that they always need to have their hair done and their nails done like a proper Southern lady. And it was just so funny to me, because it's so Southern of even like prohibition, like you're not supposed to drink, you're always supposed to look like a lady, you're always supposed to act like a lady. And I just cracked up because it's so true.
Come back, they'll see you. What does it matter, Luann? Your folks obviously know Pudge. I'm going to tell them Pudge went crazy. And then she ran off from us and we didn't know what to do. So we called the police. And the police tracked her here to Myrtle Beach.
Luann, why don't we just go up there and say this was our last weekend together. And we didn't feel like going to Fort Sumter and touring colonial homes. We wanted to go to the beach and meet boys and go to wild parties and dance. I mean, why can't we tell them the truth?
That was listener Elle Fleming talking about the movie Shag, set in Myrtle Beach, featuring South Carolina shag dancing. And, of course, that points out and illustrates the many landscapes of the South. There's rural, there's mountain, there's urban. But the rural life is the one that often gets depicted, and the one that Charles Boyer noticed the most.
Hi, this is Charles Boyer from Raleigh, North Carolina, and my pick is Sounder. It's a great film because it depicts the South as the way that it really was back when, in the time setting of the film, and really, unfortunately, the way the South is to now. There's a black sharecropper's family is just barely making it, but they're a close family. They work hard. I grew up in a South, that was highly rural. We've become quite urbanized these days. And nowadays, back in those days, I should say, it was more agrarian, and you would be able to drive through the country in North Carolina or, any of the southern states, really. And just off on the side of the road, you could see these farms where people were struggling to make it.
You've been in your house, Nathan. Hold that dog. Found what we were looking for, too. Now, you took some food and stuff from James' smokehouse last night. My deputy and me, we got to take you down to County House.
What
are
they doing,
Mama? Quick.
Get him
in the truck.
Jeff, you've been knowing Nathan for a long time. You know the kind of man he is. And you know the troubles we've been having in these hard times.
All right, let's go.
So kind of brought that all to reality because, you know, me growing up as an urban person in North Carolina, I knew of these places, but I really never knew the stories of the people that lived in them.
Charles Boyer talking about the film Sounder, film adapted from the 1970 Newbery Medal-winning novel by William H. Armstrong, talking to Marcia Gordon and Laura Boies about the South in film, and this one was based on that novel. And Laura, what imagery do we see? I mean, this is really sort of classic rural South when we see what's up on the screen, right?
Right, but what's particularly interesting about Sounders, this was made in 1972, and a lot of the images of black people on the screen were kind of related to blaxploitation movies. And here you see just ordinary people. They're a tight, loving family, and it's not a stereotyped depiction at all. And everyone in the audience sympathizes so greatly with this struggling family. That it was really unique in presenting this kind of a story on the screen in its time frame.
And it's probably worth pointing out that that was a time frame, again, coming out of the turbulence of the 60s, where a new consciousness about representation was beginning to take hold in television and film. And this is, you know, one of those films that demonstrates how this kind of protest and activism can, because it's a film that you would not have seen in 1961, most likely, or, you know.
Absolutely, 100%. And it got both Cicely Tyson and Paul Winfield were nominated for acting Oscars for this film, also very unusual. And I think it really did kind of point the way toward a new kind of storytelling, both in the movies and on TV.
Well, Marcia, you picked a film that also features sharecroppers in the South. Tell us about Mudbound.
Yeah, so this is a film that I think is, I think we're going to look back on this as an important film. It's certainly a very well-made film. It came out in 2017 and directed by a woman named Dee Reese. And this is a film that it could have been subtitled, you know, like An American Tragedy or An American Story. It's kind of the same thing. It takes place in Mississippi, and it is about an African-American tenant farmer family in the 1930s leading up to and then during World War II, and about the white community in which they exist, including the new owners of the land. And it's really so eloquently about what it is about the South, the land, its history, the legacy of slavery, white supremacy, and what ties black and white families together as well as what divides them. And many of the best scenes in the film are primarily visual. I think the one we ended up deciding to play is one when Ronsell, who's the son of the black tenant farmer family, he has gone off to World War II. He has fought. He has seen another world in which people of color are not treated with the same indignities as he has been in his life. And he comes back to his small rural community to find that he has changed, but life has not.
He is in uniform when he goes to the store. Let's listen.
You use the back door.
Go on, son. Son, we don't want no trouble here. Go on. Go on.
You know what? You're absolutely right. When we was overseas, they didn't make us use the back door. General Patton put us on the front line. Yes, sir. And you know what we did? We kicked the hell out of Hitler and them Jerrys. Are y'all at home safe and sound?
A clip from the movie Mudbound, directed by Dee Reese. Movies on the radio today. We've been talking a lot about historical films and films made about Southern history. Let's hear from one listener who nominated a contemporary story.
I'm Kareem Starks. I'm calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. The movie that, to me, portrayed the South the most is probably the movie ATL, which came out around 2006. And to me, this movie portrays the South because it's an urban South. Like, most movie portrayals of the South are like rural dirt roads and people don't have shoes. And it's like very, most of the ones are heavily segregated. It's always the theme in the movie. But in this movie, it doesn't really come up. It's really focused on like a black South, which is doesn't come up as well as much as other movies. The best portrayal of the movie ATL as part of the South is the scene at this when they go to the roller rink, and they're kind of describing the different roller groups. Yeah, but it's like a crowd shot, and when you look around the crowd, you can see people wearing baggy clothes, sneakers. You see the cars are like tricked out, like with big rims, and it's a very contemporary scene that you could see anywhere in the South.
Cascades is a rite of passage to every kid in the A, but for us, it was something more.
Here, it's like all our problems don't exist. The only place where we all felt like we could be free. School sucks, rent past due, your girl left you. Oh, on Sunday night, on none of that matter. You could be whoever you wanted to be.
Kareem Starks talking about the film ATL, the directorial debut, I should say, of the music video director Chris Robinson. Marcia, this is interesting because racial relations aren't at the center of this film, right?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of interesting. The director, Chris Robinson, talked about the fact that he really wanted to make a film that was kind of like Diner or Do the Right Thing, coming of age, and, you know, choosing to set it in this kind of capital of Black Southern creativity. And I think if you think about the films that came out, in particular in the 90s and early 2000s, they were so often centered on Los Angeles and New York and a different set of circumstances. So precisely what Kareem said in his call is right, which is a chance to see kind of young people reflected in an urban Southern context. That's rather unusual. And interestingly enough, Donald Glover has taken this up fairly recently in his Atlanta series, which I think is wonderful, surrealist, funny, smart, devastating, all those things. So there has been kind of a trajectory since this film.
Let's do this again next month, shall we?
Good idea. Let us do.
Laura Boies and Marcia Gordon. And next month on Movies on the Radio, thank you for this. This was great. Next month, we're going to talk about your favorite movies about isolation. If anybody's had any experience with that recently, you can send your favorite film about folks stranded on desert islands, drifting through outer space, alone in the woods, elsewhere, any chance that you have to be alone, which we're all looking for these days, and your chance to be on Movies on the Radio. You can send us an email, sot@wunc.org. You can tweet at us at the hashtag SOTMovie. That sounds like fun, doesn't it? We'll do that next week. Next month.
In a way.
Let's talk about it. Marcia Gordon and Laura Boies, thank you both so much for being on The State of Things, produced by Anita Rao, Amanda Magnus, Grant Hullab-Mormon, Kaya Findlay, and Stacia Brown. Jenny Lawson is our technical director. Al Wodarski helped engineer the show today. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio.